Hello and welcome back to the New History Podcast. We are on episode 5. It is myself, Alex, and Lily joining me as always. And today we've also got another Alex as a guest. Over to you, Alex. Would you like to introduce yourself and what you're all about?
Sure. First off, I'm glad to be here. My name is Alex Bronderbit. I'm a late medieval historian. And I guess a little intro about me is, I did my degree in English literature at Cal Poly Pomona, and I then moved on to King's College, where I did a master's in medieval studies. And from there, I completed my doctorate in medieval history at the University of Winchester. And I primarily work on the Wars of the Roses and sort of the political history of late medieval England.
Good stuff. So I believe there were some particular topics we wanted to get into today on things that you're working on. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I just published my first book on the Yorkist a couple months ago. Oh, gosh, actually 6 months ago. That's 2020 for you.
Yeah.
That was based on my doctoral research. It's called Political Power Brokers and the Yorkist State, 1461 to 1485. Mm-hmm. And in that book, I basically studied what I call political power brokers. These are people who sort of mediated royal power, who influenced the king. And my interest has been to date really, you know, rather than the king, but who's around him, who's influencing decisions. Mm-hmm. That's sort of been what my research has been to date.
So would you say in this sort of period, are there particular characters that come to mind as the biggest example of those power brokers?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, anybody who reads The Wars of the Roses is familiar with Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick. He's known as the Kingmaker. He's probably the power broker par excellence for much of the 1460s. And I believe multiple books have been written on him. Today, he's the one that everybody tends to think of. When I would meet somebody on the casually and say what my research is, they say, oh, the Kingmaker. So, you know, he's the one that everybody knows. But I tried to obviously, I couldn't escape him, but to look at a broader range of people, and not only looking at, aristocrats, but looking at, aristocratic women, and the clergy as well.
Oh, of course.
And really the goal of the book was to sort of establish a criteria for their observing their influence, defining what sets them apart from other people at court. And, I define that criteria by looking at things like court ceremony, patronage, intercession, a tie to the royal affinity, whether it be through the royal household. And I do hope that it's going to spark some debate. I expect that historians will say my criteria fell short here or there, or somebody should be considered a power broker who isn't. But I think that's a good thing. I'm hoping it'll spark some debate.
Yeah, there's always going to be some disagreements.
I was just going to say, I think the period that you study, Alex, is probably one of the most polemic periods in history, at least for people from the sort of Anglo-speaking world, because it's such an important sort of episode, we could call it, here in the history of the UK. And obviously being in Winchester, you were obviously in the cycle and circle of academics like Professor Michael Hicks and a few others. So from your experience, could you tell us how sort of competitive that academic field is, and how has that maybe affected your writing? Like, have you made any decisions to go into a specific sort of research route or writing route to avoid certain, polemic fields or certain figures and escape sort of that sort of snobbish behavior that there is around this field? Or are you quite happy muddling through it?
Well, it is a very competitive field. I mean, as all history these days, I feel like is a competitive field, especially given the job market in the UK and the US. I always kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into academia full time, so I didn't concern myself with it too much. But the Wars of the Roses, the figure who got me into the Wars of the Roses is also the figure I do skirt around, and that's Richard III. Mm-hmm. I discovered him, quote unquote, in my Shakespeare class when I was doing my bachelor's, and I was fascinated. But as time came on, you know, I just sort of became more interested in Edward IV's reign, the establishment of the Yorkist regime, and I really do not care if he killed the princes or not. It seems to be the debate everybody wants to wage, and it's unknowable.
People like a mystery.
They really do. And there's this strange energy around Richard. Some groups, you know, the Richard III Society, they do some good scholarship, but there's people there who really want to rehabilitate him. And I don't understand. I mean, first, I think good history, you should be somewhat divorced from your subject.
Yeah.
But it can't be proved either way, whether he did it or not. I mean, I lean towards it's likely that he did it, given he had, I think, motive and opportunity. But I don't claim to know for certain. And it's, again, it's just not a debate I'm particularly interested in. So I avoid sort of those debates. I mean, I can't escape it in my published book because, you know, Richard usurped the throne and there's political power brokers in his reign, like any other reign. So I had to discuss them. Mm-hmm. But it definitely wasn't a debate on whether Richard was a quote unquote good king or a saint or a sinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I will spill now a little secret, which many people don't know about, but it's appropriate because of this precise reason and this topic that Alex is talking about. I actually switched two of my modules halfway through my degree to avoid touching late medieval English history, like if it had the plague. I actually went and did early modern stuff, which I was just about allowed to do because, well, thankfully, because I was sort of doing more the cultural side of things and moving into, you know, more modern sources like comic books and whatnot, they could kind of glance over it. But I thought I would rather study the reign of Louis the 14th than anything related to War of the Roses because every single lecture had something to do with this. And the arguments in the classroom were just so ridiculous. I just couldn't take it. I was like, you know what? I don't care. Even though we have one of the biggest experts in the country about this subject, I will rather skip it because it was genuinely unsufferable. And you know what? I think it's actually one of the reasons why I've really not developed a big interest in this subject. Like when I originally started, I was more a late medievalist than an early medievalist. But this particular topic just really crossed me so much. It was like a ghost hunting me everywhere. You literally cannot escape it. And it's almost as bad as Tudor England. You know what I mean? It's one thing or the other. And it genuinely put me off. It genuinely put me off from studying late medieval stuff. I've later come into
kind of relate, it
as time has gone on. But particularly when it's to do with the history of the UK, for me, it's just a big gap. Of you know, right before the Tudors and right up to I would say, I don't know, after sort of Queen Elizabeth dies, that I just ignore all of that because it all mingles together, and it just becomes like a murder mystery game and who was better and who is a demon and who is not, and I just can't
take
it. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you cannot be bothered with it because genuinely. I just don't know what the big fuss is. But, you know, like what Alex was saying, everyone likes a bit of a mystery. But I don't think it's just a bit of a mystery. It's such a polarizing topic. And I think, you know, the whole thing with Richard III is that he is a very polarizing figure. So it's so easy to just...
A lot of these people seem to have been turned into big characters, haven't they?
Yeah, you know, it just becomes like a soap opera. So it's I think that's part of the appeal that it has in this particular case, but that's just my personal opinion.
I think for me it was I think what was it 2012 when Richard's remains were found, his burial was found. Yeah, so that was right when I was starting my degree, and I didn't really know what I was interested in, but kind of there was a lot of emphasis on this sort of period at the time because of that, obviously. I personally found it kind of hard to follow a lot of these stories, maybe because of the mystery or the politics or something like that. But obviously, there's some merit there if you've managed to write a couple of books on something related to this. So
yes, but you know, as I think something that it taps into a very powerful feeling, I think, with Richard III, and that is everybody loves an underdog. And for so many years, Richard was viewed as, you know, this Shakespearean villain. Mm. And academics don't think Shakespeare is history, but I can't tell you how many books are being published that still say, oh, academics view Richard as this villain and Shakespeare this, and they're still arguing against Shakespeare. And it's like, no, I feel like we've gotten to a place now where we view Richard with a lot more nuance than before. And I think that's been the case for decades now. And but still people seem to like, they want to rehabilitate him and make him this hero who, you know, against the odds, you know, he wanted to govern well, but it was just traitorous behavior that kept him from doing so. Yeah. And that just doesn't agree with facts. The right. princes aside, I mean, Richard executed people without trial, and I don't know how that can fit into this. I mean, you'll hear that that's when you run into, you know, if you say, oh, well, he executed Hastings without trial. Hastings is longstanding Yorkist. And then usually the response you'll get is, well, Hastings was plotting against him. And it's like, well, that means you're accepting what Richard said at face value. Mm-hmm. It's a bit frustrating. So, I mean, again, that's part of the reason why I've sort of disconnected from those debates, because it's just going in a constant loop. I guess it's been beneficial for people who want to keep publishing on it, but it's again, I find Edward's reign, which is longer, to be much more interesting. And again, that's why my book was based on the thesis, and the thesis was initially just Edward's reign. I had to expand it for the book because, you know, I can't leave off 2 years of Yorkist rule. Mm-hmm. But what I find interesting about the Wars of the Roses is really the establishment of the Yorkist state almost overnight, with a whole new aristocracy in many respects. And that's what I found interesting, was just how the system kind of rebooted after the Lancastrians, and then did so again with Tudor, you know, right. and then seeing, you know, these new figures and how they were wielding power, you know, that's what I find much more interesting than whether Richard killed the princes. And I have the unpopular take to say, if he did, it's probably one of the few things he did right, because if you usurp, you need to get rid of the rivals.
I guess, yeah, technically, yeah, whether it's right or wrong, it probably was a smart move.
Politically.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I've personally have always thought, you know, there's a bit too much emphasis on the importance of kings, and people act like they do everything, obviously. But you know, with what you're currently working on now, it's more about the people surrounding the king. And would you say sometimes, you know, or maybe a lot of the time, these people have a lot more influence than people give them credit for?
Yes. I mean, and there's been many works done on individual nobles and gentry. It is so easy to backslide and then just talk about the king and his achievements, when really it is, you know, the king is one person. He relies on a series of ministers and a large bureaucracy to get anything done. Mm-hmm. And really the power brokers are just the top of a pyramid, where they have their own affinities and they rely upon them. It's a big web. But, yeah, you know, the king isn't traveling to carry his diplomacy. He's not, mm-hmm. you know, he's not waging wars by himself. It's there's a big collaborative process there.
But would you even say necessarily the king is the one making the decisions?
It's hard to say.
It really depends on who it is.
I mean, it's hard to tell from the records, but I mean, there's definitely a variety. I mean, there's times when we know, oh, this is definitely, especially with Edward's case. I mean, Edward made the decision to marry who he married, because obviously his council wasn't too happy with him about that. So we do see his own initiative at times, and it's hard to tell when he does make a decision, well, who was he listening to that might have shaped that decision? A big part of my book is on intercession. And occasionally you'll get decisions where they'll say, this is made at the intercession of so-and-so. And I love when I see that, because then I'm getting clear connection between, oh, somebody putting their influence to work and getting a royal decision from it. And so that it's always a muddled to be able to determine where the initiative is coming from. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we see, again, I think foreign policy, the Yorkist foreign policy is a big one. You know, the Kingmaker, obviously, their big falling out with Edward IV was over foreign policy. Okay. Richard Neville really wanted that French alliance, but Edward was much more inclined towards one with Burgundy. Mm-hmm. And so we see the breakdown there where the counselor who's not getting his way eventually rebels. So the system breaks down there.
Okay, interesting.
On that note, can I go to something a bit more technical? Because you've spoken about seeing on the records, things that explicitly talk about intercession and whatnot. Can you tell us a bit more about what records and what sources do you actually use? Because obviously, one of the things that at least I've encountered before when dealing with this sort of thing is that depending what type of people and what type of courtiers you're trying to track on these records, it's easier cases. I was kind of curious to find out how that had affected your research and what may be some of the challenges that you have been sort of facing with this type of sources, or what sources have been more important for you to find, like, you know, if something has sort of allowed you to think, whoa, this is a major breakthrough. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, sure, definitely. By the Yorkist period, the charters, for example, don't often say who interceded for them. It's a rarity, but it does happen. So I did look at some of those charters, which are enrolled in the charter rolls. But two big sources that I relied upon, one relates to Parliament. They're called provisos to acts of resumption. So occasionally, the crown would basically review all its existing patronage, and it would decide, the king would decide, if he wanted to take it back. Okay? So it's this big act.
That's really interesting. I had never encountered anything like that. That sounds pretty epic.
Yeah, it was it was part of the push to, you know, the crown's finances in the 15th century are a mess, and the people kept pushing for, we want the king to live of his own resources. And the problem is you've alienated, especially Henry VI, you've alienated all your resources to others, so you don't have anything to live off of. So they wanted acts of redemption to bring it back to the crown. So obviously this means a lot of people could have lost an office, land, a pension. So what would happen, though, is that each act of resumption would be accompanied by a long list of exceptions. And to get these exceptions, you would meet with the king in his chamber, or as most often, you'd have somebody of substance meet on your behalf with the king. So there's the intercession component. And there would be a negotiation. Some people got to keep everything. Sometimes they kept nothing at all. And sometimes things were revised. And it was a very active negotiation, because we have these provisos where Edward IV signs off on them, but then he'll cross out certain offices. And then that will get enrolled in Parliament and be preserved, that so-and-so has, this act will not affect so-and-so, he gets to keep this office. So where this comes in handy is for two acts of resumption in Edward IV's reign, the clerk of Parliament noted on the bottom who had handed him the document. So that is a rare snapshot telling us who went into the chamber to negotiate for the proviso. So I now have a record of, okay, the proviso is for John Smith, but on the bottom here, Richard Neville interceded for him to get that grant. So unfortunately, this wasn't done regularly, so I don't have a lot of acts of resumption to look at. But for those 2 years, I have quite a bit.
Yeah, I was wondering about how frequent they were. Yeah.
Yeah, it was one clerk of parliament who did it, and he did it for all the acts. I'm sorry, all the exemptions for the 1465 Act, which hundreds of them. And then he did it much less regularly in 1467, which I only have dozens that are annotated. So it's only a snapshot. I wasn't able to talk about long-term trends, but it was a nice image of seeing who was going into the chamber and interceding. And it's not recorded on the document, obviously, but you have to assume if somebody's of substance is doing this for you, what are they getting in return? There's definitely some sort of quid pro quo there.
Yeah, obviously. That's the other thing I was going to ask. I guess that tells you just as much about not only who is affected, but obviously those people interceding on behalf of whoever they may be. Is that because they were sort of looking to advance their career or owe favors, or is that because they had something to gain from it? Do you have sort of a clear vision of what might be the motivations there, or is it kind of random?
Well, it's mutually beneficial for both parties. For the noble or person interceding, you're showing others, hey, I'm somebody of influence who can get things done. That would lend to your worship. That would lend other people wanting you to do favors for them. And it's a way of just exerting mastery over others. This is how you expand your affinity, by showing that you can put your influence to work. Which kind of leads me to the other source for intercession, where I do see clearly what the intermediary is getting, and that is the records of the towns. Every town, you know, is far away from the king, so they need somebody to intercede on their behalf. And their financial accounts list just tons of gifts, whether it be wine or delicacies, or sometimes just cash. And they'll say, this is given as a gift to this person for, and then they'll say what they're hoping to get in return. Not all the time. Sometimes they just do it to court the friendship of somebody powerful, but sometimes there was a very clear purpose. For example, Coventry in the War of the Roses supports the wrong side. So Edward IV confiscated their liberties. You then see them giving all these gifts to the Duke of Clarence, so he can intercede on their behalf so they can have their liberties restored.
Interesting.
That seems, I can see how the process goes there. But that's very interesting. I would have never thought to find that type of information in that type of records. But then again, you know, this ability to have clear, neat records for someone like me is quite a wonder. I don't really know what written sources from the contemporary period really are. So it sounds quite amazing. But on that front as well, how accessible are these records for you? Because obviously you are now based in the US. You were obviously here in the UK for a while. So are these records physical records that you need to go to the archive for, or are they published? Are they online? How do you actually get around finding these documents?
Well, they, unfortunately, you have to go to the archive for them. When I was in England, I regularly traveled because I knew I was only there for a limited time. So I took as many photos as humanly possible. You can, as you say, I am now in the US. So what I do now is I can write to the local archives and ask, you know, most of them have the capability to take high resolution photos for a fee. And because there's a fee, I have to be much more judicious about my requests, because it can get quite expensive. So no, I don't have the ability to just take a wholesale photos of a single roll anymore. I have to be much more targeted. Especially the town accounts are not available online or in print.
Not at all. So obviously that must make things a lot more difficult. So, I mean, I don't know what other type of research could be done through that type of record. But is this something that you feel has affected perhaps how some other people and how some other scholars may have done the research? Because obviously we do know some other records are more easily available, usually those that speak about, you know, rulers directly. So perhaps that's what has driven the conversation, the accessibility to some of these sources. But it's always something that fascinates me, you know, the access to well, not just the public, but the researcher to this information. Because, you know, if things are a bit obscure and you're trying to dig something out of them, like you said, it's not just the time effort, but the geographical distance and the ability to actually go in and whether they are going to charge you, you know, a reasonable amount of money or however many hundreds of pounds, which I am aware sometimes you need to pay for some of these sources, which just seems crazy to me. But I mean, it is interesting. And it does make me wonder, you know, how much limitation does that impose on a research topic like yours, which is sort of looking around those sort of key figures rather than directly at them. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I feel like I should add from the previous question too, is that some of these town accounts have been looked at by other scholars who have put them in print. So there are a few, I should not neglect to say that there are a few that have been studied. Lorraine Atreid, for example, looked at
Yeah,
and I think she also did a kind of a overview of about five towns that she looked at over time. So, I mean, there's a bit of a hit and miss there in the print scholars, but again, if you're doing a new study for original research, you know, at this point, you have to go around the local archives, which remain underused. There is an accessibility barrier there because, you know, I was lucky. I was a PhD student. I was funded, and I had, you know, the discount to ride the train everywhere. It would be quite expensive to be taking a train all over the country, accessing the archives, which, you know, the archives are free, but, you know, they might charge you £20 to take photos. You know, that adds up quite quick, all those licenses. I'm sorry, I probably didn't answer your question fully.
That does, don't worry. Yeah, no, that's good. But yeah, it's just something that, you know, particularly when we're looking at how to do groundbreaking research or moving away from what's already mainstream, it's one of the things that I always get so hot about, you know, but how are we supposed to do that as often as academia deserves if we keep on having these barriers? But, you know, it's this thing about local archives, like you said, they are so incredibly underused. Like, there's so much more that could be done with them. There are so many more that could be available there, particularly with the kind of technology that we have these days. But I guess that's a, you know, different type of conversation and a different thing altogether. The other thing I wanted to ask you,
I just wanted to add, I mean, for the local archives, I mean, you know, there's a big serendipity aspect to research, you know, and it's the local archives, which, again, were underused. That's where I would find something. Usually I didn't even know it was going to be there. I'd be surprised. That's where you find something new. And I mean, it's sort of my frustration is a lot of things are being produced now, especially for mainstream history. You know, it relies almost entirely on printed primary sources and chronicles that are in print. And my frustration, especially with the more mainstream works that are being produced, are that they're not saying anything new. And, you know, I feel like, you know, historians have sort of ceded some of the popular discourse to popular historians. And that's why there's a disconnect between academia and the more general public. That's actually something I'm hoping to kind of bridge my current work. Because I feel like you can write mainstream, but backed by new and original research too.
Yeah, I'd hope so at least. You know, I think it does happen sometimes, but yeah, needs to happen a bit more, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, I'm 100% in favor of, and it's one of the other things I was going to ask you about on another technical aspect, but obviously your writing process, you know, what you are sort of hoping to do with this book, it's, from what I understand, that this is not just appeal to academics, but sort of, you know, bring this subject a bit more to light to, let's say, the outsiders of academia that may have an interest in history, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my first book is an academic book, and, you know, so I wanted to get that done first, and I have some other academic projects in mind for the future, but I did want to write something that was this current project, which is a biography, And I wanted to write it for a, you know, a more mainstream audience, but I'm still proud that it's backed by a lot of research I did during my PhD, as well as some new research I've done remotely during this pandemic. Because, yeah, I just, you know, we're living in this time where a lot of the populace doesn't see the value in higher education, and especially humanities. You know, I hear it all the time myself. And I can't really say, sometimes I don't blame them, because, you know, academics are having this conversation and this discourse, and it's not trickling down to them, because a lot of academic writing is not accessible, whether it be in the prose they use or often the price.
That's the big thing I was going to bring up. Yeah.
Yeah. And then not only the price, but then these books are not carried in regular bookstores.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this whole conversation. I mean, we might have these new discoveries and new takes on Richard III, for example, but if it's only being had in academia, it's not getting to the general public. That's why they still think Richard III might be a Shakespearean type villain.
Yeah.
And people having those discourses with the people are more popular historians who are excellent writers. I mean, there are some good popular historians out there. I've been publicly critical of some of public historians, but there are some excellent ones. But
yeah, of course.
A lot of them just don't have any of the new research. They're not backed by the research. And I feel like both can happen.
Yeah, there doesn't necessarily need to be a big gap between the two sides, does there? You know, it should really overlap, and it does in some places. It just, you know, it's not always the
case. Trying. Just give me a few more years. I'm trying desperately. But no, I mean, it is true, and it's something that I was gonna ask you from a, you know, technical point of view, particularly for, I guess this may be more interesting for people who are actually in academia than outside of academia. But from your publishing experience, can you give us a bit of an insight of, you know, the role that the publishers actually play into sort of affecting, you know, what you're writing, how you're writing it, and the audience, and sort of how you've navigated the two books almost from two different sides of the coin, I guess. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. Well, so from the academic publication side, I mean, you have free rein on what you're writing, and there's no meddling there, really. What happens is, you know, it goes off to anonymous peer review by other scholars who will have feedback, and you can take it or ignore it. It's just, if you ignore it, you might want to explain to them why, because if, you know, you get a negative report, the publisher might not continue with the publication process. But so really, you get constructive feedback by anonymous reviewers after the first two chapters, and then when you have the full manuscript to complete. Whether they're the same reviewers, I'm not entirely sure. In my case, I think they were different. And the editor really just focused mostly on, you know, making sure you're adhering to style and formatting. They might give you some feedback on, you know, hey, this didn't seem clear, but otherwise the publisher was very hands-off and supportive. You know, I worked with Boydell and Brewer, and they were fantastic. They believed in the project, honestly, even at a time when I didn't. So I do appreciate that. And my current publisher for the more mainstream project is Pen and Sword. And the editor has been reading some of my chapters, and he's mostly just giving me feedback on, you know, again, is this readable? Is there anything where, you know, you have typos here, or, you know, there's something you can expand on? But it's been kind of the same. It's been a bit hands off. It won't be peer reviewed. But it'll just be, you know, the publishing editor. I mean, that's what happens with these mainstream books. There's not the peer review aspect. But
so that's the only real difference then.
Yeah, I mean, personally, what I'll end up doing on my own is I'll send it to other scholars that I trust, because I want to get you know their feedback before, because I'm sure there's something I miss or some source. You know, I want to have that for my own peace of mind.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's interesting, at least I think, that, you know, it's, I guess, it's a double-edged sword, or it can be, because, you know, us in academia can be so pedantic sometimes about the peer reviewing process. Like I've had some pretty obnoxious experiences with peer reviewing for others peer reviewing for me, and usually the peer reviewing is blind, but sometimes you actually know who the person is, and that can put a lot of pressure. And in some more unfortunate cases that what Alex is presenting, you can find yourself in a bit of a pickle if the person who is peer reviewing has an agenda or a completely different point of view, and that can cause some tension with the publishers or the editors as well. But it's kind of funny, like all of the loopholes that you need to pass for an academic project that has already sort of been discussed, because you know you cannot just go and say, "Hey, publish this book." You know, you've had to have some previous conversation, in some cases, actual proof of what the research is about and whatnot. But if it's for the mainstream reader, it's like, yeah, okay, cool, your word is good enough. It just seems a bit sort of unfair. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but I kind of wish they kind of had a bit more of a balance in that sense. You know, you still need to fact check and things like that when you're writing for a mainstream audience. Otherwise, you could just be, I don't know, saying that the earth is flat and everyone would believe it. So it's weird in that sense. It's never made a lot of sense for me.
So you'd prefer something somewhere in the middle then?
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, as you say, it's the double-edged sword of more mainstream publishing, is that some stuff that gets through, again, there's been so many books on Richard III. I mean, at some point, they're not saying anything new. It's just, it's an area, I mean, I'm being a bit cynical here, but I mean, Richard III and the Wars of Roses is a very popular subject, and I feel like some people are capitalizing on that.
They're definitely more of a commercial product sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and... I do wish there was a little bit more of a gatekeeping there, just to make sure, like, is this, I mean, first off, is this factually accurate? Sometimes, and I'll read stuff where it's like, you know, the dates are wrong, and like, that's where a peer reviewer can at least catch some of those minor quibbles.
Yeah.
But yeah, a little bit more would definitely, oversight would be nice, because again, the mainstreams, they're going to be read by a lot of people. And, you know, once those ideas get out there, they're really hard. It doesn't matter how many academic articles are being published, they're not being seen by the general populace, you know? Yeah. So these ideas, these outdated or sometimes incorrect ideas, just stay out there. And, you know, I guess with whether they think Richard III's a villain or not, it's not like it's causing great harm to our society, but I don't know. I just think, like, we should try to strive for as accurate as possible and to educate.
I can definitely see, you know, there could be an issue with both approaches. You know, if you're looking at the more the popular historian approach without the peer review, you know, you're going to maybe regurgitate the same views because that's what people are familiar with, that's what people want to read. Whereas if it is peer reviewed, then maybe if you are trying to go for a different interpretation, that might be potentially looked down upon depending on who is looking at what you've written. So I'm sure that doesn't happen a lot, but I'm sure it can.
Yeah, I mean, a good peer reviewer should review and say, "Hey, I don't agree with this, but you know, it should go forward." That's what a good reviewer should know. Where I don't agree with your conclusions, but your research is sound, and this should go forward, and then the rest of the field can decide for themselves.
Yeah.
You know, my book, the initial reviewer. Was, you know, just absolutely hated it. And it was the, this seems like there was a bit of an agenda, but the editor actually, I accepted the review, and the editor actually said, "No, we're going to send this to a couple of other people just to get a second and third opinion."
Right.
And because, you know, it's just how it goes. And to be fair, I didn't know what I was doing, and I kind of sent a little bit too much of a thesis chapter. So there was some valid pushback there too. I needed to rework it more into a proper book chapter rather than, you know, what was still very much a thesis.
Okay. So what was the issue there? If you're able to get into that, well.
Oh, I mean, it's been years now, but. You know, I felt like they just thought, you know, it was still, you know, looked like a thesis, and I think in part they felt like the book had already been done.
Right. Okay.
You know, the editor thought disagreed on that one. So, you know, it's hard to remember. Like, it's been about 5 years. So.
Yeah.
That's okay. I kind of read once, curled into a ball, and then I crumpled it up and moved forward. As you should when in peer review.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's interesting that you've mentioned this, because that's, you know, for people out there who may be studying history or looking to go into publishing or whatever, that's a genuine well, not so much issue, but something to consider when you're actually writing. Up until the moment you kind of finish your PhD, you've been taught to write and do research in a very specific way, and keep your style and your tone in, you know, sort of within these parameters. And once you're actually writing past your thesis, you're a doctor of history or philosophy or whatever your title may be, and you are out there in the real world talking big words to big people, and it's completely different. It's such a completely different scenario writing your thesis or even a research paper than writing a book. And it's not actually something you get incredibly prepared for when you're studying. You kind of have to, like Alex said, you kind of just have to figure it out or get feedback and help from other people to actually find the right form of putting the research that you've done into the right words, if that makes sense. And sometimes it's not even about the words, it's about the pacing, it's about the style, the way you're connecting the information is really strange. So it's really weird. And I think once you've gone through the process and you start reading other history books, you can sort of really start telling the people who pretty much just took their thesis and chucked it into a book and sort of be done with it, and the people who actually made a book out of the research, because it's not the same. It's not the same being a great researcher and producing great research material than actually being a historian who can write a book that is comprehensive and doesn't feel like you're just chewing through words. And I think that's actually a big problem in academia. You know, we have great researchers, but not necessarily great accessible writers, and it's,
I guess,
a
that's
great,
why the popular historians exist, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's a huge barrier, and that's really where the public historians can just cut in, because they may not be as big on the research side of things, but they can write in a way that is more digestible. You know, at the end of the day, what good is the information that you're providing if the people on the other end of the page can't actually comprehend it? If it just goes straight through your head, then it was brilliant, but I didn't get it. So
I think I've had a similar, like, small taste of that with, you know, I did my undergraduate degree and then was writing for our blog. So going from writing essays to writing just informal articles on the blog about whatever I wanted, you know, I kind of had to maybe unlearn a little bit of some of the things that were a bit, you know, made it less interesting to read when I was doing it in a more academic style. But you know, not to say there's no reason for it, but
I mean, I give them their credit. They're good writers and they're able to break it down and make it accessible to others. I mean, my background, well before I went to academia, I was doing public writing. I had a stint in journalism. So that was a struggle for me so much. I mean, and I do enjoy writing for the popular side. I mean, I've written some magazine articles. I do like telling this. I find the stories to be fascinating. So I enjoy telling that to the public and sort of bringing that to light. And just thinking back to your earlier question, Alex, I was thinking about what was some of the issues with the book in the first draft. Mm-hmm. And I think the most valid issue that came to light, and it actually came from my later down the road with a reviewer, was I was still lacking that definition of the political power broker and that criteria. Because once I had the criteria established, it was then defining the rules by which I define a power broker and giving anybody who might read it in the future something to respond to or disagree with. That was still some in the thesis, even my thesis, I think I was still a little bit too nebulous, but with the book, I had to make it concrete so it could be responded to.
It makes sense. Yeah. I suppose it is a thing that can be end up being loosely defined, but as long as you've got something consistent within your own writing, then people can either be free to agree or disagree with your criteria. So,
yeah, I mean, it just served to anchor the rest of the work. Otherwise, yeah. I could have been, you know, this guy's a power broker, you know, and it just could have been like everybody could have had different criteria, and it just really served to sort of put a structure on it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Excellent. Well, I'm becoming conscious of the time, so I think we should probably start wrapping up. But before we do that, I was wondering if you could tell us about perhaps a moment when you've been doing research and you found, whether it was a record or a story or information that really made your day and was truly unique and actually really helped give your book, you know, the new flavor and accent that you were looking for, like that sort of moment of, you know, eureka sort of thing. Have you had any experiences like that that you can share with us at all?
Sure. Actually, it was something that came up last week. It was very small, but I mean, I got excited about it.
That's all that matters.
I'm working on this biography right now on John Lord Wenlock, and I was kind of drafting the first chapter on his family, which is a bit obscure. So I've been chasing over after scraps, really, and trying to piece things together. And I found quite a bit on his great uncle, who grew to be quite wealthy and really served to sort of propel the family to that next layer, that next level of power into the gentry. But I found his will. And it was quite interesting because, you know, the subject of my biography, John, we don't know exactly when he was born. It's usually estimated between 1400 and 1404, based on when we know he reached his maturity. And in this will, which was dated 1391, it mentions a John Wenlock, son of William, which sounds like it could be the subject of my biography. So it's quite interesting because either initially I thought, oh man, he was much older than we thought he was. But I said, you know, he died in 1471. I was like, I really don't think he was on the battlefield in his 80s. So it's probably a son of the same name who predeceased the subject of my biography. Okay. But it's just kind of thing that just excite me. You know, it's not, this William Wenlock, this person, this great uncle of his, you know, it's not somebody really well known. And, you know, I'm finding scraps. I'm talking about his tomb, which still survives. It has some nice evidence to it. When I found the will, I got probably the best sense of him because it was a very generous will, left money and horses to all kinds of people. It speaks to obviously the wealth he acquired, even though he was a priest. And then it fleshed out some of the family connections that I haven't been able to establish anywhere else. Like, I did not know, and I've never seen that John Wenlock seems to have had a sister.
You know, okay, so a whole other couple of characters have just come out of nowhere. So,
yeah, just to help flesh it out. You know, like, it doesn't. I can't say much about her other than she existed. But you know, that's the part of the research I love.
Yeah.
Great. Well, that sounds like a neat little story. I guess these things sometimes happen. You know, you come along with this. It may not be something incredibly big, but it just helps you shape things in a bit more of a precise way or give you a different sort of perspective on something. And it can really make things interesting while you're researching, just coming at, you know, with these sort of unexpected characters or figures that then suddenly, I guess they just make the puzzle a bit more whole, putting like a little piece more in there or whatever. But no, that's pretty sweet, I think. On that note, though, that's probably all we have time for today. So before we wrap it up, Alex, is there anything else you would like to briefly mention? The floor is yours.
Well, let me just add on to that last bit and say, you know, as historians, we have to settle for the small victories. It's the small victories that, you know, send us further along until we can find the big find, like, you know, Richard III's journal saying he killed the princes. you know, I'll settle for the small things. I'll just thank you for inviting me to come speak with you. I've really enjoyed it. I've been a podcast junkie for 10 years. I've never been on this side of the mic before.
Oh, well, brilliant.
Well, then that's all good. And we're very, very grateful to have you on board. And hopefully in the future, you can come back again and we can talk about something else, maybe a third book or, you know, whatever you got going or whatever topic, you know, you're always welcome here. So thank you, Alex, for that. Thank you, Alex, for hosting as usual as well. It gets confusing when there is two people here with the same name. I'm not sure if you guys know who I'm talking to, but that's fine. So thank you all the Alexes in here today. And thanks everyone out there for listening. And that's us for today. Good night.
All right. Bye.